Speaking of dead vibrations. Okay, let's do this thing. Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we are talking to Alyssa Solomon, who is a photographer, among many other things. Welcome, Alyssa, to Zero Hour, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, the food is yummy.
Yes, I know. The service stinks. Actually, I was interviewing somebody who asked me one time whether or not they had to leave the tip, and I said yes. So, well,
it's community radio.
Yeah. You come from an interesting background. You studied undergraduate at Kenyon College, which is a well-known college. You got an MBA in finance at the University of Chicago, which is also a well-known college. And then you toddled off to Penland School of Crafts. So let's talk just a little
Justify
bit about that.
Justify my background?
Yeah, just a little bit about your background.
So Kenyon's a fantastic liberal arts school.
Right.
And I have an art degree from there and concentrated in photography. And got out in the middle of a recession and got the kind of work that people with an art degree got, which was in consumer goods advertising. And I didn't like it.
Restaurant work? Good for you. Had a girl.
And I didn't like consumer goods. And yeah. I didn't like that aspect of that aspect of work and what we were selling.
You mean photographing consumer goods?
No. Strictly, worked at Tallheimer's in the advertising department. And
okay.
So I was part of the promotions department and where they were producing those ads by hand for a newspaper.
Yeah, right. Back in the good old days. Right.
With those type machines. Right. And if you made a typo, you had to actually reproduce the whole line of type.
Right.
And make a new plate.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working really hard and had a lot of energy, you know, but was working really hard. And my father, who taught college, had a student who, he taught poli sci, and he had a student who got an MBA. And she liked her work, and she was making a ton of money, and she was working hard, but she was doing all these interesting things. And he said, you ought to go figure out getting an MBA. And I took the test and I had took some finance classes at VCU to see if I was good at it. And as a photographer, you know, I'm pretty good at math and analytic stuff.
Interesting, yeah.
And so I went to business school at the University of Chicago because I figured I knew I could do creative thinking. And a lot of business school at that time was beginning to expand into the case method to demonstrate that the geeks could think creatively. And I thought if I went someplace like Harvard or UVA where they have a really strong case method, nobody would really take me seriously. So I applied to University of Chicago, which has a very quantitative program. I think 25% of the students were engineers.
Really?
And there was probably another like 30% were finance or econ, and there was 3% other, which included all liberal arts. And so I got a finance degree there because I knew if I wanted to get a job that in that field, I would just have to have this piece of paper that said I could think analytically.
Right. Yeah.
And it was I learned a lot.
I'm sure.
So from there, I went into investment banking and did during kind of the glory days of before the last financial crash, did mergers and acquisitions, primarily of insurance companies. And it was very engaging and I worked really hard, but it was corporate. And so I paid back all my student loans and owned my brain back. I'd had unmortgaged my brain.
Right.
And my husband and I moved back to Richmond after that. And so that meant that I could still, you know, use my trade, my finance skills, but I also
something was still.
But I could, and I kept a studio, but didn't really have a diligent art practice. But it was at coming back here and being in the kind of unique art community that Richmond is that I could begin having more time to go back to art making, and because everybody here has a trade, there wasn't any kind of questioning about my seriousness of intention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of like being in New York. Nobody's really a waiter.
Yeah.
Or they're all waiting. Or waitress. But so your movement back into the arts, when did that really start to gain momentum again in your life?
As soon as we moved back, one of the impetuses for moving back was my mother wasn't well, and I wanted to make sure that I was present for that process of being part of her life. Mm-hmm. And she had had a small accounting practice, so I came back to work with her to make sure that could exist right. with her.
Right.
And the she said, there's this class at the Virginia Museum and you should go there and take it. And I went, I don't know why. She's like, you will need to go do this. And I went, and Kate Fitt was the instructor. And Kate is such a nurturing person. Mm-hmm. And so from the get-go, I was immediately kind of poking at what it was, and had kind of over the next 5 years were building objects, sculpture, a lot of figurative stuff mm-hmm. out of found objects, doing some fabric work, bringing the two things together, and had gotten to a point where I was building figurative sculpture that in my mind was clearly looked like people, but it was, they were all made out of junk.
Right.
And so to share them with others, I went to a photographer, and a photographer took pictures of them, and they were perfectly fine documentary photographs, but they didn't have any of the magic or the life that I saw in these objects. And I had been trained as a photographer. I knew how to use a camera. I don't know why I needed someone else to,
someone else to go do this for me, but I was trained.
I knew what to do. So, I think it probably was even my brother-in-law, who's a writer, said, why don't you just take pictures of these things yeah. and see what comes out of it? And so at that point, I started photographing the objects. But one of my longtime interests has been the history of photography, photography coming into the world at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. kind of what it represented in the in social history and the changing of the social and economic landscape, mm-hmm. What it represented about people's access to memories and objects about and precious objects and family. And so I had these figurative objects, and I had a camera, and I thought, I'm just going to tell the stories about these people, these objects, in the context of portraiture and in the context of traditional portraiture, mm-hmm. and began creating setups, almost like photo studios, at
really?
A miniature scale to photograph my sculptures. And that then opened the door where I could really just spend my time thinking about how we read. Not only do we read the human form, but how do we read the reproduction of the human form in the mm-hmm. form of portraiture?
What is that? I mean, I think I'm sure you understand what that means, but I'm not sure I do.
What? What? Well, I think kind of the classic example is you can start with something like clouds, and you look at mm-hmm. a cloud, and you can see a horse, and the person next to you sees a horse, and
right.
that there's something about that cloud that's very horsey. And you look at kind of another kind of classic example is you look at those coin-operated binoculars at, mm-hmm. at the seashore,
right. yeah.
and you look at that and you see the face. There's two yeah. holes where the eyes should be, and there's a little round
right.
coin exchange where the mouth should be, and everybody reads that as a face.
Mm-hmm.
At a more subtle level, we have all these cognitive processes where I can recognize danger or fear or anger through just subtle gestures of a face. So we all have this innate understanding of how to read the human form, and we
right.
need just the least amount of clues. And then you couple that with the traditions of portraiture, which are really, you know, breaking down now, but from the inception of photography from the, you know, 1839 until, you know, 5 years ago, there was a way that people got their pictures taken in a studio. There was
okay.
a kind of backdrop,
right.
often one that had a landscape to
right.
it.
Woman was seated, man was standing.
There'd be props
right.
that all had, you, there might be a book on the table. There would be a tree stump to
mm-hmm.
indicate mortality. There would be a kind of...
Did people smile back then, or is that a new invention?
Very little smiling. And
yeah.
I think a lot of it, you know, I think a lot of it is how people interacted with each other. People didn't smile as much in a formal setting. It was
yeah.
considered impolite.
Yeah. 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 I talked to a Russian one time, and I said, how come Russians never smile in photographs? And I'm not sure if that's true or not, but it seemed to be. He said, because when you're smiling, you look like an idiot. But, you know, I mean, but in our, you know, in our context, you know, the, what's the first
Why
thing somebody says?
Why do fashion models never
Cheese!
Smile?
You know, that's true. Fashion, that's very well said. Yeah, right. So getting back to your ideas, because I think that's really central to your work, your ideas, and those are really important to you. Talk a little bit more about portraiture is the departure point, I guess, is where you really started from. And when you say portraiture, you're talking literally about portraits of initially sort of abstract objects that represented figures. But where did it go from there? It must have captured you somehow.
Yes. So at this time that I was, you know, thinking about this reference to an old way of picture taking, that you had the backdrop and the backdrop elevated the subject and the gesture communicates something to the viewer. I realized that I relied on the sophistication of the viewer, that I could easily count on the viewer having all these skills to interpret. I didn't have to have wall text that said, this is supposed to be a person. I could count on you as an active participant in the viewing process to have all those skills. And that was really freeing because I had this way of making you part of that process, right, the viewer part of the process. And kind of as a sidebar, I remember making all these images in earnest and sitting in my studio and learning how to do lighting and trying to emulate all the ways that a portrait photographer would light a subject with reflectors, but everything on this tiny little scale, kind of being
and
really.
You, at the time, you're using a regular 35 millimeter. No,
absolutely, yeah,
oh, you 30, were, yeah.
Regular
you
35 regular millimeter, and that worked reflex. For me because the prints would be small, and that's
black
kind
and
of
white,
the size
color.
Of black and white because it's
white.
Very good at being suggestive, depth of field, so that I could put things in the backdrop. That, you know, I remember when someone saying, "That's such a great portrait at Niagara Falls," I was like, it's a placemat. But, you know, depth of field and kind of the right. tricks of lighting and setup could really create these illusions that so I could count on the viewer to fall for.
So what got you to being a daguerreotypist, which I'm sure is
you
a word
that
many, many people are familiar with, because I certainly know a lot of daguerreotypists myself. But what
– how
I'm a collector of daguerreotypists. I just like to say the word, actually, because
they're
I'm always
very
amazed.
Strange.
I'm always amazed when it comes out right. So how did you become a daguerreotypist? How did that sneak into your work?
So along the way, I was making these portraits, and then I started using kind of small dolls and figurines, and kept thinking more and more about these things not being read as images, not being read as what was in the picture, but being things themselves. And so for me, a framed photograph wasn't going far enough. And I started thinking, how do I make these pictures be read as precious objects, physical objects? And there's a whole
as opposed to just an image.
Exactly.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
And there's this whole history of photographs that through just kind of the requirements of the technology were just these big clunky objects that weighed a lot. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking, okay, what can I make? And at that time, I won a fellowship from the Virginia Museum, so I had this pot of gold that I could invest in what I was going to, what I wanted to learn. And I made some cabinet cards that are paper cards that you've probably seen all kinds of 19th century prints put on, and they have the name of the studio at the bottom and the photographs mounted on it. And so I kind of made a contemporary version of that. And again, always thinking about this idea of reference, not reproduction. I didn't want it to look old fashioned, but I wanted the person to look at it and know, hey, she's talking about something from the 19th century. She's making photographs that are precious. So I had the opportunity to kind of figure out what to do. And I, you know, dithered around with some different things that I had taught myself. But up to that point, I'd basically used the same photo paper I had used since I was in college.
Right.
I used the same kind of lens I had used since I was in college. I really was much more interested in what could I get out of the lighting and this, what could I get out of what I put in front of the camera, as opposed to what was, you know, being some kind of gee whiz scientist of photography. And so Jerry Spagnoli, who is one of the key people in reviving the daguerreotype, had been teaching a class regularly at Penland. So I had the opportunity, you know, Penland's not very far. It's really fun to go to. It's really beautiful. And I signed up, got in my car, listened to some excruciating David Sedaris tapes on the way across, you know, 40 across North Carolina, and learned how to make
daguerreotypes. We're going to have to tell people what this is, otherwise they're going to...
What a daguerreotype is?
Yeah, they're going to think you're like a court reporter or something.
Right.
Yes, this is a really interesting interview with my court reporter. For all of those of you who think that's not an art, I've got news for you.
Can you hear the clicking?
What is this thing?
Okay, so daguerreotypes, there were two forms of photography that were invented in 1830 or announced to the world in 1839. All the research to be able to make an image that was permanent had been going on for decades beforehand, and it was the holy grail of chemistry and optics was mm-hmm. to capture an image. And in France, the research was being done by a man named Daguerre.
Right.
And in England, it was being done by William Henry Fox Talbot. And Daguerre announced his process to a council of scientists and great thinkers in 1839. And what he came about... What people had known was that there were light-sensitive salts
right.
that were composed primarily of silver. That was one of the main forms. And people knew that. And if you had a silver salt and light hit it, it would capture the image mm-hmm. or the light pattern.
The light pattern, right.
And they knew that there were things that you could put this silver salt on that would hold it so that you could focus a lens on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they just didn't know how to keep the image from going away. Mm. And what Daguerre began working with was in this really great kind of primitive way. He silver-plated metal, so he got his silver.
Mm.
And then he exposed it to some chemicals that created a silver salt actually on the surface using the
okay.
silver from the plate.
Mm-hmm.
And then things that are called halogens, the column in the periodic chart, iodine, bromine. And... that plate then becomes light sensitive, and so you've got something that's 4x4. Yeah, it's radio, so I can't have my show and tell that would make everything clear. But you have a plate that might be, you know, 2x3 inches, whatever size, and that would be coated with silver, become light sensitive. Plate goes in the camera.
Yeah.
Light comes through the lens of the camera, hits the plate.
Right.
That then gets processed, and that's your image. You only have one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was
so you
like
make
a Polaroid.
Prints or you just,
no, it's
because no,
there's no way to.
There's no negative.
It's one. It's like a Polaroid. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. just one.
Okay.
And so that means that it has a lot of very cool attributes. One is that it means that light has come bounced off of you,
right.
Tim, come through the lens of my camera,
mm-hmm.
hit that plate,
mm-hmm.
and so it's like a footprint or
right.
amber that the light that has touched you. So there was this fabulous exhibit of the work of these really grand 19th century photographers, Southworth and Hawes, who photographed through daguerreotypes the elite, the glitterati of Boston society.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this magnificent picture of Daniel Webster with the eyebrows and mm-hmm. the puff chest and the threatening stance. And there's this plate that means that the light that bounced off of Daniel Webster hit this plate
right.
and changed these silver
right.
crystals
right.
and then was fixed.
Right.
And so it's like...
It's almost like archaeology.
Or like a footprint or a fingerprint, that it's an
yeah.
actual attribute of the person
kind of like
who was
the,
photographed.
You know, in the cave paintings, you know, with a handprint like on a cave painting, or the fact that they would put their hand up on it and spray the paint from their mouth over the thing. I mean, it just has that sort of wonderful sense of time and history captured there. That's always been fascinating to me about photography.
And that, I think, so it's working. It has that in to the viewer. The modern viewer looks at it and goes, gosh, it looks like he's alive. But then it also has that underlying truth to it, which it is actually is a residue of that person.
Exactly.
Daguerreotypes, you know, if you see my work, or you look at 19th century daguerreotypes, or you look at another contemporary daguerreotypist work, there are daguerreotypes seem to hover, and they look like holograms. That because the image is just really on the very surface of this
right.
mirror polished silver plate, the light is passing through the crystals, hitting the mirror behind it, and coming back through. So they really look like they're illuminated from behind. So that becomes like a very cool trick in my little arsenal of tools, because mm-hmm. in this contemporary world, I look and I think, I know what the presidential candidates look like. I know what the president of Kenya looks like.
Right.
I know what the plants of New Zealand look like because of photography. And so everybody who is looking at art has all this built-in knowledge about how to read photographs, and I'm competing with all those other images that they've had in their lives. Mm-hmm. So in a way, going back to these processes that create images that are familiar, it's a photograph, but it doesn't look like a photograph I know, gives me a kind of trick to arrest somebody's attention.
Yeah, becomes more of an object than just an image.
And an unfamiliar experience.
So so that's sort of the technology of it, but what are you working on now, you know, through this medium? How do you apply yourself intellectually through this medium?
One of the things that I talked about a little earlier is that I began becoming really interested in how we know things and how we use those systems of knowing to understand the world. And we do that in a very unconscious way. And then, of course, this very contemporary idea is that we need to be responsible for understanding how we're understanding, because otherwise we don't know the limits of our biases, our understanding. Right. We draw conclusions that are incomplete or self-limiting. Mm-hmm. And so we really have a kind of, now in contemporary culture, it's so much of what people are being taught, how to understand the systems of how you understand things. And then you couple it with a kind of political mandate, which in you know, the most recent administration, the one in which we are still citizens, everything's been about the message, not the underlying idea.
Right.
You declare victory, won.
Right.
And so...
Well, it's sort of a hyper-reality.
And as citizens, we have this real responsibility to be able to separate all that out.
Right.
So I have this kind of abstract interest in systems of knowledge and then this mandate of being a citizen to understand systems of understanding. So photography becomes this really great foil for that because the camera, now everybody knows the camera lies. It's how, as it goes through the camera, it is transformed and you get these objects that are another version of reality. So then you take it a step farther and you say, okay, these objects are daguerreotypes. So they're another version of reality that's hyper real. They look like holograms.
Right.
They look like they're 3D. They look like there's a reality there behind the wall. And yet they don't exist.
Right.
They're just dust on a piece of silver.
Right.
So along those lines, to kind of tackle that head on, and I should also say that daguerreotypes probably like 90% of all the daguerreotypes that were made in the heyday of daguerreotype photography up through the 1850s were portraits. So there's this huge tradition of portraiture in For me, I thought, well, you know, at this point, and there's been a lot of work in between, but I need to honor that tradition. And so I started thinking about how are people defined and how do they define themselves and how do they understand who they are? And they understand them through, in a lot of ways, the books they've read, the systems of knowledge that they have been taught, and people are taught through books, and then they codify what they know by reading additional things, and that eventually we can only know what our systems of knowledge allow us to know. And yet we also define ourselves by our book collections and by the ways that our experiences that then shape our next experiences. So I've started doing these portraits of individuals through their book collections. And so on a certain surface, the daguerreotypes are almost still lives. They're collections of books. They're very, design, dramatic, they're, you know, you're using the space, these objects, book objects.
Right.
They also have all the kind of resonance people feel for books.
So it's actually the images of the books.
Exactly. And these books are often given to me by by someone, I'll say, can I borrow, you know, will you give me a box of books? And I'm going to photograph them. And so, because I'm not really interested in the actual human form. I'm interested in how we read the human form. I'm interested in humanity. But a picture of a person doesn't do it for me. It's not something I'm interested in doing. And so that idea of how do you honor the traditional portraiture and yet get at how do people define themselves? And one of the longtime themes in my work has been collecting and how people, that Wunderkammer, the 15th century, 16th century ideas of collecting, where you would, you know, try to build some system of the world. So you would collect everything that was spirals and you would think, okay, the world is built on spirals. So I'm going to buy, I'm going to collect shells. And if I'm very powerful, I'm going to send ships out to collect shells for me. And, if I'm only kind of powerful, I'm going to just send my maid out to get some shells for me. And then I'm going to, you know, take branches that grow in spirals and collect the world. And then I develop a system of spirals. So these ideas that people would begin to define the world and understand it through what they collected. And then that next step is, okay, a kind of collection being collections of books. So the recent show I had, there's some images of banned books. Delightfully went to the got a list of books that have been banned.
It chose books, though. I mean, because in this culture now, especially, you know, I mean, I certainly don't think that reading is by any stretch of the imagination dead, but there seems to be less of it going on, and information seems to be coming in so many different formats now.
But you know, there's a lot of formats, but a lot of it's still words.
Yeah.
You know, it's books on CD. It might be downloadable books. It's the newspaper. It's going to be even, we just got a TV and look at how much of the screen is occupied by words. But yes, it is definitely arcane. And if I'm going to be in there for hours at a time, I want to handle things that are smelly and romantic.
Have something really wonderful.
Okay, so I fess up. Yeah, it's arcane.
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay.
Hey, I like FM radio too.
Yeah.
And how passe is that?
So, yeah, I mean, you do a radio show.
I do.
Yes.
And I do it under an alias, Peace One, and it's Can't Stop the Music on the Mighty, mighty WRIR on Sunday nights with Bill Fair from 9 to 11 p.m. And we describe
which
it as...
Which is exactly the same station as we're on now.
I know. It's the best station. And I hope you run this show during the pledge drive.
I'll have to come sing on your, on your show. That's probably not something you want me to do.
It depends what kind of music you've got.
Yeah.
So we describe our show as a bubbly, cheesy goodness. So it's outsider music and found sound and... a lot of very bad music. Although a couple of weeks ago we did a jazz show and it was all good music.
It was all good jazz.
It was really good jazz. A lot of bebop.
There's room in the world for
we usually have a theme.
Uh-huh.
This week's theme is going to be space in honor of the total eclipse of the moon next week.
Oh, I didn't even know the moon was eclipsing next week. Just shows how in touch I am. I got to get out of the studio more.
Open the windows.
Really? Start reading a book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. If someone wants to see your work, I know you just had a show at the Page Bond Gallery, but that closed on February 2nd, I believe. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. How would people, is there a website? Can they access you? Can they take a look at what you're doing?
Now, Paige is lovely and has back stock. So she often has my work up in the back or in one of her smaller showing rooms. But she has a website, www.pagebondgallery.com. And there's also, for those of you who want to know how daguerreotypes are made, who else are making daguerreotypes, all kinds of arcane aspects of the daguerreotype process. There's a really nice website done by the beloved Charlie Schreiner called www.newdags.com. And my work's on there, and there's a lot of work by, there's probably about 20 people representing anybody who's got any the world.
I just want to put one last thing in here. I was reading some information about you, and you are one of the only or one of the few female daguerreotypists. I love that word.
And I have chest hair.
Me too. Maybe there's a future for me. Outside of radio. Well, Alyssa Solomon, thank you very, very much. This has really been fascinating. It's obvious that you have a tremendous amount of energy and interest in this and other intellectual kinds of things. But I think what you've shared is taking the medium that sometimes, you know, certainly can be suffocating, which is photography, and turning it into a real intellectual tool to explore the things that really fascinate you and interest you, as opposed to just ending up with an image. I think you said early on before we got on the mics, you said, you know, you're an object maker.
Absolutely.
Do you hold to that still? Yes?
I do.
Yeah.
I do, because at the end of the day, these things exist in the world.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you again, Alyssa Solomon. I really, really appreciate it. And thank you, folks, for listening. We hope to see you for lunch again on the radio next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring. You're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. It's Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.